Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the court. We have one case this morning, United States v. Metz. Major Hotard, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, sir.
And Major White, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. Major Colin Hotard on behalf of the appellant, Corporal Bradley Metz. Chief Judge Olson, may I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case is about law enforcement violating the law to gain an advantage. Out of all the evidence that derived from these violations, none was more important to the government's case than the interrogation, and it should have been suppressed for two reasons. First, the interrogation was not attenuated from a preceding constitutional violation. And then secondly, a 31 Bravo violation rendered the interrogation involuntary. Now, before discussing the violations, I want to just discuss the timeline of events as the facts unfolded. So the NCIS agents report to the scene of the crime. Right after, they go directly to the appellant's barracks from room 208. This is where they obtain statements from the appellant without advising those 31 Bravo rights. They then break contact, go back to their vehicle, and they devise a plan to further their investigation. Minutes later, Agent Perry arrests the appellant, knowing he lacks probable cause to do so, which brings us to the constitutional violation and the attenuation doctrine. Now, the touchstone
of the — Let me ask you this. Did he need probable cause to apprehend in the — or at least detain him in the breezeway?
Well, Your Honor, he did not have probable cause, and — obviously, there's an exception for a Terry stop, but here it was not a lawful Terry stop, and I can explain further.
Okay.
When the Agent Perry gave a variety of reasons of why he was detaining the appellant. He first stated that appellant was acting strange. He was acting strange because he had his hands in his pockets, and that because he was purportedly slow to remove his hands from his pockets, Agent Perry apparently possessed a reasonable and particular suspicion that he was armed and dangerous, right? But this overlooks one important fact, and that is when he handcuffed the appellant, he had already frisked him. He had already determined that he was unarmed when he put him in handcuffs. Additionally, Agent Perry gave another reason for why he was detaining the appellant. He stated, and this comes in page, Joint Appendix page 100, he said, but most importantly, I just didn't like his behavior at this point. This is not a particular and reasonable suspicion that appellant was armed and dangerous. But I think what's more important is that so there's two parts to this arrest. There's that initial arrest and the prolonged arrest. And
so basically you might be saying is that even if his initial encounter was supported by the law under Terry stops, that he prolonged it afterwards, unreasonably so. Is that what you're getting at as well?
That's
I'm not asking you to concede the first part.
Right.
But I'm asking you, is that kind of a follow-on your argument you make?
That's correct, Your Honor. Regardless if the initial stop was a Terry stop, there's nothing in the evidence to support that the prolonged arrest, which stretched for 6 hours, was a lawful stop, right? There's nothing in the record. The government's argument is based on pure conjecture because there's nothing in the record to support that. And as a further indictment of the law enforcement's activities here, there's numerous NCIS reports in the record of trial. Not one of them mentions any fear, officer safety concern. Not one of them mentions that appellant had his hands in his pockets. They didn't even mention that he was even arrested. They concealed this fact. Agent Perry created this hindsight justification after a motion was filed. So the idea that officer safety motivated the initial arrest is unreasonable. And additionally, there is zero evidence in the record to support that it justified the prolonged arrest. The fact of the matter is the purpose of this arrest was to collect evidence. It was investigative in nature. Agent Perry determined that he was, quote, zeroing in on evidence pertinent to the investigation. This is moments prior to arresting the appellant. After he arrests him, but he also realized that he doesn't have probable cause to obtain a search authorization. So he seizes the appellant to seize this evidence. He brings him upstairs back up to his room while he's still in handcuffs, and who's waiting for him but Agent Thompson. Agent Thompson is waiting with a search authorization for him. He detained the appellant so that he could seize the evidence. This is investigative, and this first prong certainly favors the appellant in this matter. Additionally, the other two prongs of the Brown analysis are the intervening circumstances and the temporal proximity between the illegality and the evidence that it seized. Now, the government must show that the taint of the violation had dissipated by the time that the evidence is collected, and this prevents the suppression of evidence that is remote or unforeseeable. But here, the record supports that it was neither remote nor was it unforeseeable that he would consent to a search of his room or an interrogation would transpire. Again, Agent Perry brings him up to his room, and she's waiting, and Agent Thompson is waiting with the search audition form. While he is still in handcuffs, he is asked if he, quote, has anything against them searching his room. After or during the search, he is standing by as they search his room, his barracks room. Afterwards, they tell him that the search raised their suspicion, and they have some more questions to ask him. They then put him back in handcuffs, and they drive him down to the NCIS station for an interrogation. Again, this is neither remote nor is unforeseeable that an interrogation would transpire. Additionally, I think it's just important to keep in mind that this is a continuous custody. From the time that he is initially arrested throughout the interrogation, he is in custody. There's no break. This is one chain of events after another. And this comes from Culp v. Texas. Culp v. Texas Supreme Court lays out whether or not someone is in custody, and it states whether a reasonable person would have felt free to leave, whether a reasonable person would have felt that they could ignore the police and go about their business. And quite simply here, if you look at the record, it supports that he did not feel free to leave. He, while the search is being conducted, the appellant asked one of the agents if he could go to the chow hall. And the agent responds, words to the effect of, we'll be out of your hair soon. He took that to mean that he couldn't leave.
Can I roll you back factually your timeline just for a minute? And before I do that, though, did you get promoted since the last time we saw you?
I did, Your Honor.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much, Your Honor.
All right. That out of the way, what are you saying about this from a factual matter? Let's go back to when they he gets frisked and is taken up to the room. Now, is it factually established that the handcuffing took place after he frisked, after he was frisked, or when he got to the top of the stairs to his room? What about these handcuffs? It's still not clear to me from what I've read in the briefs of factually what was established there. You know what I'm asking?
Yes, Your Honor. And to answer your question, there's been no finding on whether or not he was handcuffed before or after he was frisked. But the only evidence in the record states, and granted, it just come from his declaration, the appellant's declaration, but the only evidence in the record states that he was handcuffed before he was frisked before he was even handcuffed.
Okay, now let's assume for the moment that we agree with you that this is an unlawful detention, and that is the illegality from which we are trying to determine attenuation should extend. Okay? What about, can you go back to what you mentioned about his having been asked consent or sign the CCA seems to think that the signing of the consent to search form or pass, as you all refer to it, is somehow an intervening event. I gather you disagree with that. But what is it you're saying when we look at the Brown factors? What happens and what prong of Brown are we talking about when we get to the point where he's asked to sign the consent form?
Right, Your Honor. So
you're saying basically that he was compelled to sign the consent form because he was in handcuffs and had just been unlawfully detained, right?
I'm not necessarily saying he was compelled or coerced. It's not an issue of voluntariness. We're saying that the consent pass did not cure the illegality. And again, he is asked while he is in handcuffs if he consents to a search, if he has anything against him searching his room, and he's only released to memorialize that consent. Mm-hmm. And at Brown, there was two Miranda waivers after an illegal arrest, and that didn't cure the taint.
Counsel, on this factual point, I'm looking at the CCA's opinion, and they say, once back at appellant's room, S.A. Papa removed the handcuffs. At the time, the special agents did not believe they had probable cause for a search authorization, so S.A. Tango asked appellant if they could search his room. Now, that sounds like a factual finding by the CCA that he was released from the handcuffs and then they asked him for consent. Are you saying that this is ambiguous and we shouldn't take that as a factual finding, or are you saying that this is clearly erroneous?
If that is a factual finding, that is clearly erroneous, because the only evidence in the record is that he comes from the appellant and Joint Appendix page 710, and he states that he was asked if he could search his room while he was still in handcuffs. But again, I point to Brown, in which there's two Miranda waivers that didn't cure the taint, and then also point to this court's decision in Darnell, which there's two 31 Bravo waivers and then a consensual search, and neither of those three things cured the illegality and cured the illegal arrest.
Right. One other, and I will yield my time to the remainder of the bench here. The two Brown factors you've mentioned, you say or argue that those favor your client in this case. But what about the third factor in Brown as it pertains to this detention or apprehension that occurred in the breezeway and then up the stairway up to the office? Is it your view that the third factor of Brown is in play or not in play here, or because we're talking about flagrancy, right? It's a flagrant conduct, the kind of misconduct that the law is determined to deter on the part of the police.
Yes, Your Honor, and if I could just...
What's flagrant about this in your view?
Yes, Your Honor, and it's flagrant or purposeful, and when the courts say that when the intent is to collect evidence, when it's investigative in nature, is purposeful. So purposeful is part of that third prong of the Brown analysis. But additionally, as this court stated in Konkin, unnecessary or unwise conduct is also considered flagrant. This court in Darnell stated that sloppy police work is also considered flagrant and justifies the exclusionary rule. Here we have investigators. We have two NCS agents who don't know basic investigative standards. They don't know the difference between probable cause and reasonable suspicion. We have investigators who aren't putting very important facts in their investigation, facts of arresting an appellant without probable cause. We have, most importantly, when we talk about flagrancies, we have Agent Perry, who is knowingly arresting the individual, knowing he lacks probable cause to do so. This court stated in Comsuk that when law enforcement intentionally violates what they know to be a constitutional command, exclusion is essential to deterrence. He knows he lacks probable cause, and yet he still arrests the appellant. This is flagrant conduct, Your Honor.
Before your time runs out, and following Judge Sparks' question, okay, so if we assume all three of the Brown factors augur in favor of your the appellant, what about inevitable discovery?
Right, and Your Honor, there's two points on inevitable discovery. First, there's no practical certainty of what evidence will have been discovered. The record doesn't support what evidence with practical certainty would have been discovered. Secondly, and most importantly, there's no evidence that the agents were pursuing this evidence at the time of the illegality. The standard is what they were pursuing at the time of the illegality, and the record simply doesn't support what evidence would have been discovered and what evidence would not be discovered.
Counsel, what about the fact that we're reviewing this under an ineffective assistance of counsel situation? There was no motion, and we have to determine whether counsel was deficient in not making this motion. And, you know, we've just spent a long time arguing about whether the motion would have been successful or not. How does the ineffective assistance of counsel lens affect your argument?
Well, Your Honor, so the lens is whether there's a reasonable probability that the motion would have been meritorious. And I can point to Darnell and Comsuk, which are very similar fact patterns, which show that the motion would have been successful. And as I stated, in Comsuk, the agents possessed a good faith belief that they had probable cause. They thought they had a deserter warrant and thought that they gave them the right to go into a house and arrest Comsuk. The court disagreed, but said he at least had good faith. Here, he knowingly violated a constitutional right.
Well, the question is not whether there was an illegal arrest necessarily, because you have to show an illegal arrest, and then you have to show that it wasn't attenuated. And it's really the attenuation issue. Was the counsel deficient in misjudging whether the Brown factors would say there was attenuation? Isn't that the question?
That's correct, Your Honor. And we go back to the fact that and I'm going to focus on the interrogation. The interrogation, this is one continuous custody for a six-hour span from the initial arrest to the end of the interrogation, is roughly 6 hours. He's in custody this whole time. There's no attenuation. Again, he is not the taint has not dissipated. He's not provided any kind of notice that previous evidence cannot be used against him. He's not voluntarily reengaging. He hasn't had time to consult with an attorney. This is a comprehensive custody that lasts for 6 hours, Your Honor. And so basically both the search, the fruits of that search, and also the interrogation were not attenuated, because it was one, the illegality had never ceased to exist. Did that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes.
Just briefly, if I could just, with my time remaining, just discuss the 31 Bravo issue. Our position is that he was a suspect from the get-go, and when the agents approached the appellant, they knew of a means, motive, and opportunity to believe, at least a mere suspicion to believe, that appellant had committed the arson, and they violated Article 31 Bravo, which consequently rendered the formal interrogation involuntary.
Counsel, what do we do about the fact that the military judge found that they did not have a subjective belief that he was a suspect at the time?
Yeah, so it's both subjective and objective. And to address the subjective belief, Your Honor, I see my time has expired. May I finish answering the question? In regards to subjective intent, the subjective belief, they were considering the wrong investigative standard. They thought that probable cause was required before reading 31 Bravo, not a mere suspicion.
But wouldn't we have to find that the military judge's finding of fact was clearly erroneous to reach that conclusion?
And, Your Honor, I apologize for not giving you a better answer. I do not recall the military judge making that finding. That sounds more like a legal conclusion. So I apologize for not a thorough answer there. But, yes, if that was a finding, then I would submit that it was clearly erroneous, because they didn't even know the investigative standards, Your Honor.
In terms of the subjective belief, what about the statements that were made by NCIS to the accused, where they essentially said something along the lines of, it's not like I randomly showed up at your door, and also we have hard evidence you're our guy, that's why we came to your room. Is that subjective evidence of what the NCIS agents were thinking at that time?
Yes, Your Honor. It certainly was subjective, a peek into their brain of what they were thinking. So that would go to the subjective intent of the agents, Your Honor.
Thank you. Further question?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major White.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I am Major Candace White, and along with Colonel Joseph Jennings, represent the United States. This court should affirm for three reasons. First, appellant was not a suspect when first screened by law enforcement. Second, the lower court did not err when it applied Brown versus Illinois, as the motion to suppress would not have been meritorious. And third, the evidence would have been inevitably discovered. Article 31 Bravo rights are required when someone is a suspect. And under Swift, that does involve more than a mere hunch.
In that regard, Major White, I'd like to point your attention to page 17 of your brief, where you're discussing issue one and you say, quote, before the agents went to appellant's barracks, only two facts distinguished appellant from any other Marine who worked in the facility's building. One, his supervisor's statement that appellant was a problem child, and two, appellant's status as a key holder, end quote. Conspicuously absent from that is any mention of the grudge evidence, the fact that they were told that the accused had a grudge against the staff sergeant whose logbook and hard hat with the chevrons was placed on top of the pile of wood and lighted on fire. Was there a reason why you omitted that point?
Your Honor, and we specifically said facts when it came to suspicion. So the distinction between a hunch and a suspicion, hunches are based on intuition, whereas suspicion is based on facts. And in the facts here, Staff Sergeant Stewart is the one who said that the appellant was a problem child and may have been implicated. And if you turn to page 683 of the Joint Appendix, the agent even wrote, Staff Sergeant Stewart said Matt's the appellant, has a bad grudge. So that's not necessarily imputed onto the agents when it comes to whether or not they were suspicious of appellant. And also, if you look to the Joint Appendix, page 84, 268, 318, and 475, Staff Sergeant Stewart actually provided 3 to 4 names of people who may be implicated, and more importantly, Staff Sergeant Stewart himself was eventually a suspect in the investigation and was brought in for interrogation in his possible involvement. So in looking at what the agents knew versus what they intuited, the only facts that they had at that time was that appellant was issued a key. He may or may not actually be in possession of that key. And
what case law do you have that would support that notion that we have to segment it that thinly, where you talk to someone in a position of authority as an NCIS agent, they provide you with motive, saying there's bad blood between these two, there's a grudge. And importantly, then when they go in, they find that it is that specific sergeant's hard hat with the chevrons on it and the logbook that's been placed on fire. You're saying that the NCIS agents should not have considered that in determining whether the accused was a suspect?
They should have considered it, Your Honor, but it's not determinative. And U.S. v. Davis...
But it's a factor, isn't it?
It could be a factor, Your Honor. We don't consider it a known fact, per se. And if you look at Joint Appendix page 476 through 77, Staff Sergeant Stewart actually says that a number of Marines in the unit had grudges and could be implicated. And looking at U.S. v. Davis, in that case, the agents had similar information that the appellant in that case had unrelated disciplinary problems, he had some mental health issues, he'd made threatening statements to law enforcement, and that still wasn't enough for this court to find that he was a suspect at the time of his interview.
So if we're looking at it, though, in terms of a mosaic approach, we've got, it could be characterized as motive evidence, this grudge. We've got means because of the no forced entry, and NCIS was told that the accused had a key. We've got propensity. He was characterized as a problem child. And then we've got in this Venn diagram where it's focusing in an exclusion concept in terms of you've got someone in position of authority saying to NCIS, if there's one person who did this, it would have been an accused. Why isn't this mosaic approach, the winnowing down, the correct prism through which the NCIS agents ought to have answered the question in their own minds about whether the accused was a suspect or not?
Well, Your Honor, at the time that law enforcement first got that information about appellant, it was in the very, very introductory phases of the interrogation. And as the agent said, other people don't run their investigation. They have to pursue leads. And just as in Davis...
So, I understand your point.
Yes, sir.
But what does it matter? Was it the very preliminary stages in the investigation? What does it matter that NCIS agent says they don't get to run the investigation? We're talking about the information that had been supplied to them when it's a simple determination of, should we consider this accused or this person a suspect when it comes to reading them their rights?
Yes, Your Honor, and the government's position is that it takes more than the fact that the appellant may or may not have had a grudge against one of his supervisors and also that he had at some point been issued a key but may or may not be in possession of said key at the time. And again, turning to Davis, even once that investigation had narrowed to three to four personal pool cue owners, it still had not sufficiently narrowed despite someone having the instrumentality of the assault in that case. So just as someone had access, i.e. the appellant potentially had a key, that is not sufficient to narrow the scope to make him a suspect versus the law enforcement conducting screening interviews.
So then what are we to make of the issue that I raised with the appellant's counsel, where during the subsequent rights advised interrogation, the NCIS agents said to appellant, we have hard evidence you're our guy. That's why we came to your room. And they said, it's not like I randomly showed up at your door. Doesn't that show that in the minds of the NCIS agents that, in fact, they did consider him a suspect?
No, Your Honor, because that is it's well established that law enforcement can lie to an appellant in order to encourage their cooperation in an interrogation or an interview, and that's exactly what law enforcement was doing here.
So where is that in the record? You're saying that we just adopt your analysis as counsel here? We don't look at what is in the record, and that is those statements, as compared to your saying, well, we know they said this, but the ways of the world tell us that they didn't mean that when they said that to him. How do we as a court say we're going to ignore what the plain language was in the record before us?
Your Honor, the law enforcement agents don't use the phrase futility approach that the government uses in its briefing, but they do explicitly testify that at the time they approached appellant's room, they first approached appellant's room, he was not a suspect. So that's what the government's relying on, that their mindset at the time they approached his room, he was not a suspect. And they made those types of statements in order to convince him to participate in the interrogation.
And when they said that he was not a suspect, were they using the correct legal standard?
At one point in the record, they were not, Your Honor.
Right.
Counsel, can I bring you back to one? I think it's a small detail, but it might be important. You just recently said that he may have had a grudge against one or more of his supervisors. Wasn't the evidence that he had a grudge against the shop? And I bring that up because, of course, he burned down the shop. He didn't do something against a particular – well, he's not been charged with doing something against a particular supervisor. Does it make a difference?
As far as whether he was a suspect or it was a screening interview, Your Honor?
Well, I mean, this grudge evidence seems like it's pretty important. And the evidence was he had a grudge not against – I mean, I think it just said he had a grudge against the shop. And he's charged with burning down the shop. I mean,
and Your Honor, that all the grudge information comes directly from Staff Sergeant Stewart, who not only himself was a suspect, but also on Joint Appendix page 476, he says, quote, most of our Marines are always disgruntled. So that kind of opens the playing field to the max. I was like, I could easily see Coles, Narrow Green, or Metz doing it. And then I threw Fernandez's name out there. So yes, it is a factor to be considered, and it was considered by law enforcement, but it's not determinative in and of itself. Again, just as in Davis, the appellant there had negative information, this negative information relayed by Staff Sergeant Stewart was not in and of itself enough to transform appellant into a suspect, and law enforcement indicated numerous times in the record that they were, in fact, conducting screening interviews.
Major White, what, if any, difference is there between a person of interest and a suspect?
Yes, Your Honor. It's not well defined, but what Davis tells us is that whether someone's a suspect is a matter of law. And again, going back to the hunch versus suspicion analysis, hunch is more based on an intuitive nature that is developed through law enforcement experience and training, whereas a suspicion is, again, a legal standard that triggers things such as 31 Bravo rights or Miranda rights or other legal requirements. So under Swift, the court encourages to objectively look at the facts and circumstances at the time to determine if someone is a person of interest, vice, a suspect. In this case, the fact that law enforcement was conducting screening interviews is indicative that they found appellant to be a person of interest, vice, a suspect, that based on their training experience and expertise, they were pursuing all investigative leads to either rule out people for involvement or to narrow the field for further investigation and further questioning. And that is why, upon learning from the command, who were key holders, they immediately went to the barracks where all the key holders live to see who actually has a key, if they did not have their key, where it was, if it had been lost or loaned out, and where they were. So in looking at the screening interview questions themselves, they also show that appellant at the time was a person of interest because the questions were not specific to him. They were generic in nature. They were looking to where his whereabouts were, what he knew about the burning building, kind of a brief alibi.
But when you're saying they were just general questions, you yourself talk about the Farini method. You're just lowering the person into a sense of complacency, but you're really locking them into their story. So when you're saying they were just generalized questions, what does that matter in terms of our analysis?
It goes to the first encounter, Your Honor, that when they first went to the room, and I think it's important to note that in the record, the law enforcement agents testify, they don't go directly to appellant's room specifically. They didn't know which Marine lived in which room. They just knew the Marines all lived on the second deck of the barracks building. So they were attempting to get basic, broad information as far as key location and individual location to then narrow the search down to who might be involved or who else might have access beyond the five or six named individuals who were issued keys.
Yeah, before we run out of time, I want to kind of pivot, if maybe you're about to pivot, to the potentially unlawful detention. And the government's position with regards to the initial detention and handcuffing of the appellant, and then what transpired thereafter.
Yes, Your Honor. And the government has conceded that the detention from the smoke pit up to the barracks room while the appellant was handcuffed was an unlawful extension of a lawful initial detention Terry stop for police safety. But in looking at the Brown test in particular, this was not a flagrant or purposeful violation. This was very similar to that in Kamsuk, where law enforcement in that case knew they could not enter the home. They had even asked the homeowner if they could go in and were told to wait outside. But when they saw the appellant in that case approach the door, they had concerns for officer safety, so they illegally entered and apprehended appellant. They then escorted him to the following room where they released him, gave him the permissive authorization search, and then subsequently searched his bag.
But isn't there a distinction there? They'd already determined that the accused did not pose a threat here.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why the government concedes that follow-on handcuffing was unlawful. But there is attenuation. It's not large in time. But the signing of the pass is an intervening circumstance. And while the court in Brown specifically held that Miranda rights...
Now, you say it's an intervening circumstance, the signing of the consent. Why is that? If it's a situation where he gave verbal consent, which he did, didn't NCIS at that point have the authority to search, even though he had not yet signed the consent to search form?
They did, Chief Judge, and the signing of the pass indicates...
So why is it then an intervening event if consent had already been given orally?
It goes to show good faith on the part of the law enforcement, Your Honor, and that implicates the third prong of the Brown test, which the court has found to be of particular importance, because the intent in suppressing evidence that doesn't satisfy the Brown test is to deter purposeful and flagrant law enforcement violations. So the good faith effort on behalf of law enforcement to not only get the verbal consent but to also get the signed pass shows that this wasn't purposeful or flagrant. They had good intention to ensure that the appellant was giving informed consent, and that it also shows under the Brown test, where in that case the Supreme Court refused to find that a Miranda warning in and of itself is sufficient to attenuate the taint. A pass is distinct from Miranda rights because it's interactive. Miranda rights are passively received by the recipient. There's not a dialogue back and forth of understanding. However, in the execution of the pass, especially in this case, appellant gave the verbal consent. He was then given the written pass form where he signed eight times. Initialed eight times. He signed it. He dated it. He asked questions and discussed it with the agents. So while it wasn't a large temporal attenuation, there was that interactive dialogue and behavior that attenuated the illegal stop from the search. And more importantly, even if that first search and also the interrogation were suppressed, this evidence would still have been inevitably discovered, which is why, again, going back to the Strickland test, the motion would have failed. Specifically because if you look at what was actually found, on 20 May is when the first search occurred, and all that was found were clothes with fuel on them and a lighter. The shoes were seized from a common area. The interrogation, appellant did not give any incriminating statements. He actually gave a false alibi. And then after that interrogation, he was able to go home. He was able to take stock of his room. He was able to evaluate what evidence was or was not still there. And he was even able to talk to Corporal Taylor, who he convinced to give a false alibi in support of his false statements to law enforcement.
But I don't quite understand your argument here. You're saying all they found was shoes with the accelerant on it. All he did was give a false confession that they proved wrong and that they shoved down his throat during closing arguments and got an instruction from the military judge that was damaging to him. So why are you saying this was all of no consequence?
Your Honor, because if you look at what was seized during the second search, which was a full 24 hours plus after the initial contact, and there was multiple rights advisements, multiple two pass forms signed, that's when they found fuel-soaked gloves, and they found the key hidden in the box. 21 May is also when the agents reviewed the key card information, which is when they established that the appellant entered his room very shortly after the fire alarm went off. It's also when they interviewed Corporal Taylor, who was the alibi. They reviewed footage of where appellant said he was. They also conducted further screening interviews, which ruled out all other suspects. So they were well on their way of finding this information out, even without the clothes and the lighter seized on 20 May and without the statements from appellant during the first interrogation. So, again, applying the Brown test, the third factor is the most informative, according to the Supreme Court. In this case, it was not a flagrant violation, and it was not purposeful. It was for law enforcement safety purposes. And in looking at the Strickland test, it was not a failure by the trial defense counsel to file a motion, as it would not have been meritorious. And even if it was, there would have been no different result because of the evidence would have been inevitably discovered. And I see I'm running out of time, so pending any questions from the court.
Chief, I fear my question may require a couple more minutes of counsel.
Absolutely. Take as much time as you'd like.
Very well. Thank you, sir. Major White, let's assume for the moment that the court disagrees with you on whether or not the accused, or the appellant in this case, should have been administered 31 rights at that initial encounter. And let's put together with that your concession that the unlawful detention is another illegality, all right? So now you would have two illegalities, right? And evidence discovered farther down the timeline. The other thing I want you to address in my question here is that, given that theoretically you might have two illegalities, which would be the intervening event to attenuate, for attenuation purposes? Would it be the signing of the consent form up in the barracks when they, after they detained him? Or would it be the interrogation or, the interview later after they drive him back to the NCIS office?
Your Honor, those would both be, but also and possibly most importantly would be the second pass that was executed on 21 May, since that was completely distinct and separate from any of the illegality, even the hypothetical illegality that you proposed. That was all on 20 May. On 21 May, after appellant had slept in his own bed, had been able to just talk to Corporal Taylor, had been in his room to take inventory, 21 May was when a fresh pass was executed. So that is probably the most determinative intervening factor that would attenuate any of the taint from the 20 May illegality, even the hypothetical illegality.
I see. Thank you.
Further questions?
Counsel, when I read our test about whether or not a person is a suspect, and it says at the time of the interview, the military questioner believed or reasonably should have believed that the service member committed an offense. What threshold of belief do they have to have? So from the government's view, it can't be they're convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. The only thing I can find in our case law, it has to be more than a hunch. Those are two pretty big extremes. Does the government have a view, or if we were going to write an opinion that we could maybe clarify with that standard, does the government have a view of what the level of certainty of the belief that they've committed offense ought to be for someone to be designated a suspect?
Yes, Your Honor. The government's not aware of a case that defines it per se, but Meeks is informative. The concurrence in that case actually used the Webster's Dictionary definition to distinguish hunch, saying that it's a strong intuitive feeling. And they go on to say the fact that there is a hunch that a crime has been committed does not trigger 31 Bravo. So looking at that and then also comparing it with Swift, looking at the facts and circumstances at the time, it would need to be something that is above a threshold of just a law enforcement intuitive feeling, and something that an objective person, maybe even a non-law enforcement person, could objectively say, this is more than a hunch, this is more than a law enforcement intuition. This person should be considered a suspect at this point, if that answers your question, Your Honor.
Well, it's hard to define. So, thank
you. Yes, Your Honor.
Any further questions? Thank you, Major White. Major Hotar.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just 2 points briefly. First, the government would not have been able to prove their case without the interrogation. The interrogation provided the motive or the theme of the case of deception and destruction. The deception was made up of statements made in the interrogation. As the interrogation was published for the members, they would pause it and have witnesses rebut claims made in the interrogation. Additionally, as Your Honor pointed out, it provided for a false exculpatory statement instruction, which allowed the members to infer his guilt based on the statements made in the interrogation. The government states that the gloves found the next day, they could have proved their case based on the gloves found the next day. Even Agent Perry stated that there was numerous reasons that his clothes could have smelled like gasoline. He worked around fuel. Agent Perry smelled gasoline and still didn't even think he had a reasonable suspicion. The claim that they could prove their case based on gloves that smell like gasoline just doesn't pass the sniff test. Additionally, the government points out that Staff Sergeant Stewart didn't provide a list of states that Staff Sergeant Stewart provided a list of suspects to law enforcement. No, Staff Sergeant Stewart provided a list of key holders. It was a name of 5 people on the list. Staff Stewart stated that if anyone would have committed this offense, it would have been the appellant. Additionally, based on what Staff Sergeant Stewart told law enforcement, Agent Perry wrote that appellant holds a bad grudge against the facility. Additionally, the government quotes Joint Appendix page 476. This is testimony from Staff Sergeant Stewart at trial. This was not his testimony at the suppression hearing. One final point on 31 Bravo, Your Honor. Davis is an opposite. In Davis, there was a nexus between the motive and the crime that was, there was no motive between the motive, there, excuse me, there was no nexus between the motive and the crime that was committed. What they knew, what the law enforcement knew in Davis was that Davis had made threats to kill police officers. But as law enforcement testified in Davis, they weren't investigating a shooting, and they weren't investigating a shooting of a police officer. Here, there's a clear nexus. He held a grudge against the shop, and the shop was set on fire. And if anyone would have committed this offense, it would have been the appellant. And yet, law enforcement did not read 31 Bravo rights.
Counsel, yes, I want to give you the same opportunity to answer the question that I asked the government's counsel. Does the defense have a view on what the appropriate threshold of certainty needs to be for someone to be a suspect?
Your Honor, I would point to Swift when it talks about mere suspicion. A mere suspicion that someone has committed an offense triggers 31 Bravo. And I think a rule should be drafted, I would submit, that prevents circumventing 31 Bravo, where law enforcement can provide self-serving testimony in hindsight and simply get away from providing 31 Bravo rights, Your Honor. I see I've run out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
All rise. Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.